Good afternoon, everybody. A press release with the Argenx fourth quarter business update and full year 2017 financial results became available at 7 a.m. Central European Time today and can be found on our news and events section on our website. Before we start, I'd like to go to slide 2 to remind you that forward-looking statements may be presented during this teleconference. They may include statements about our future expectations, clinical development, regulatory timelines, the potential success of our product candidates, financial projections, and upcoming milestones. Actual results may differ materially from those indicated in these statements. Argenx is not under any obligation to update statements regarding the future or to confirm those statements in relation to actual results unless this is required by law. I'm joined on the call today by Tim van Hauwermeiren, CEO of Argenx, and Erika Staudy, CFO. On slide 3, you will see a brief agenda for the call. Tim will highlight recent news, including our latest public offering, and provide an update on our clinical programs and our collaborations. Erik will then provide financial results for the year, and finally, Tim will lay out upcoming milestones before we turn the call over for Q&A. I would now like to introduce Tim van Hauwermeiren, CEO of Argenx.
Thank you, Joke, and warm welcome to everyone. Throughout 2017, Argenx achieved numerous corporate and clinical milestones, bringing us steps closer towards our ultimate goal of becoming a fully integrated commercial stage company that delivers transformative antibody-based therapeutics to patients with severe autoimmune diseases and cancer. On slide 4, you see that our ability to generate highly differentiated antibody molecules stems from the fact that we address novel or complex targets using our cutting-edge antibody discovery technologies. Then, our innovative access program allows us to work in close collaboration with leading academic groups and innovative startups which possess deep mastery of the target biology. We focus on indications with high unmet need where we can take our programs through clinical proof of concept and possibly registration ourselves based on approved endpoints. We have been able to mature a unique and sustainable pipeline, with 2017 certainly being our most successful year to date, positioning us for a productive and catalyst-rich 2018. Slide 5. In May 2017, we completed a NASDAQ IPO, raising gross proceeds of approximately $115 million. On the heels of our encouraging clinical data in December 2017, we closed an oversubscribed public offering with gross proceeds of approximately $266 million. Through this raise, we were able to grow our blue-chip, long-term institutional investor base that is closely aligned with us on our business plan going forward. We also now have the ability to aggressively advance our lead candidates, as well as fund our earlier stage pipeline and expand our team, particularly in the United States, where we recently opened our stateside headquarters in Boston. Slide 6. In the second half of 2017, there were significant updates from our most advanced candidates, Argenx-MOM13 or efgartigimod, in development for rare autoimmune diseases, including the initiation of our phase 2 trial in pemphigus vulgaris, the initiation of our phase 1 trial to evaluate PKPD safety and tolerability of a subcutaneous product, and most notably the positive results of our phase 2 trial in myasthenia gravis, which we announced in December. As shown in slide 7, Argenx-MOM13 is an IgG1 Fc fragment exploiting the natural binding site between the IgG Fc tail and the recycling receptor FcRn, equipped with our proprietary ABDEC mutations. Given that MG is one of the autoimmune diseases where we best understand the role of pathogenic autoantibodies of the IgG type in driving the disease and the severe limitations of current treatment options, there was a clear rationale to pursue MG as our first indication. Slide 8 shows how we assessed the treated patients. The primary endpoints of the study were safety and tolerability, and secondary endpoints included improvement of the disease score from baseline, assessed by four recognized MG scales. And in addition, we monitored total IgG, pathogenic IgGs, PK, and immunogenicity. Let's move to slide 9. To reiterate our findings, the data showed a tolerability profile that was consistent with the findings from our phase 1 healthy volunteer trial. Most treatment-emergent adverse events were mild, and there were no severe adverse events reported. We observed an 83% response rate in the 113 treated patient population. Even in this small sampling of 24 patients, 12 per study arm, we observed a strong efficacy signal in the 113 treatment group, with 75% of patients achieving a lasting response versus only 25% of the patients in the placebo group, as shown on slide 10. Importantly, we saw a clear separation in clinical improvement between the treatment group and placebo after just 1 week or one dose. Additionally, the duration of the response lasting at least 6 weeks further supports the long-lasting PD effect of our drug candidates. To contextualize our findings, I would like to point out that this overall response rate is in line with what has been reported for plasmapheresis, the gold standard therapy in MG, and that our sustained response compares favorably with the reported 2 to 4 weeks for plasmapheresis, and all of this with a safety and convenience profile, which is leaving plasmapheresis far behind. Slide 11. MG is a serious autoimmune condition, causing periodic muscle weaknesses that can progressively worsen and even be life-threatening. It is an orphan disease with an estimated 64,000 patients diagnosed in the US, of which an estimated 55,000 have generalized MG, for which current treatment options remain very limited. Aside from the recently approved Soliris, this space has not seen any innovation in the past 40 years, and current therapy typically consists of corticosteroids, immunosuppressants, and IVIG or PLEX. In general, these options offer inadequate efficacy, slow onset of action, and significant side effects. We are incredibly pleased not only that Argenx-113 showed a strong tolerability profile, but that the data also demonstrate a rapid and sustained benefit in disease score, which was found to correlate very well with reduction in pathogenic IgG levels. We are committed to bringing this drug forward to commercialization as fast as possible and plan to initiate phase 3 development before the end of 2018. Additionally, in April of this year, we plan to present the full MG data set, including specific IgG reduction levels, at the American Academy of Neurology annual meeting. Overall, as presented on slide 12, these data were incredibly important in underscoring the mechanism of action of Argenx-113, validating our scientific approach and furthermore our rationale in choosing autoimmune indications mediated by pathogenic IgGs. These data supported our findings from our preclinical and healthy volunteer studies, showing rapid onset of action of the drug, as well as strong duration of response. Furthermore, these data allow us to move forward into our other Argenx-113 trials with a stronger sense of how the drug really works. There are many IgG-mediated diseases that may benefit from the degradation of circulating autoantibodies, meaning we have the opportunity to create a pipeline within a product around several potential indications, as is shown in slide 13. We had a three-pronged rationale to selecting our first indications to study. First, based on the ability of Argenx-113 to reduce levels of circulating IgGs, we looked at indications where pathogenic IgG levels predominantly mediate disease. We then considered indications we believe we could confidently bring forward ourselves, namely orphan indications that would require smaller, more focused trials, and which we believed had clear regulatory paths. Finally, we selected indications for which clinical proof of concept will be strong enough to have an impact in adjacent indications. With these criteria in mind, and based on significant unmet medical needs, we decided to focus on myasthenia gravis, primary adult immune thrombocytopenia, and pemphigus vulgaris. We believe there are other autoimmune diseases that may benefit from this mechanism of action, and we plan to expand our development efforts in other diseases mediated by pathogenic IgG autoantibodies. Today, we are nearing the completion of patient enrollment in our second phase 2 trial of Argenx-113 in immune thrombocytopenia. As a reminder, presented on slide 14, the study is a double-blind, placebo-controlled study enrolling up to 36 ITP patients with platelet counts lower than 30 million per milliliter. Argenx-113 will be dosed on top of current standard of care, corticosteroids, and or immunomodulatory agents, and or TPO receptor agonists. The primary endpoints of the trial are safety and tolerability, and secondary endpoints include effect on platelet count and use of rescue treatment, and an assessment of PK/PD as well as immunogenicity. Today, we have two updates to the ITP program in the form of amendments to the phase 2 study, slide 15. First, we elected to extend the follow-up phase, which follows the treatment phase, from 8 weeks to 21 weeks. We also added a one-year open-label extension study to allow relapsing patients the option to be evaluated on the high dose of the drug candidates at 10 milligrams per kilogram. Our goal with these amendments is to gain as much patient exposure to the drug candidate as we can, and also ensure we understand its full duration of response in order to best meet patient needs. We look forward to our top-line phase 2 data readout in ITP in the second half of 2018. This is our beachhead indication to other severe blood disorders, and a positive result in ITP could open up an important development opportunity for Argenx-113 and our pipeline within a product approach. Also, in the second half of this year, we plan to announce interim clinical results from our third phase 2 trial of Argenx-113 in pemphigus vulgaris, an indication we carefully selected based on its severity correlating directly to pathogenic IgG levels, as well as the large unmet need in the space. As shown on slide 16, this study is an open-label and non-controlled study and will enroll up to 12 mild to moderate PV patients who are either newly diagnosed or relapsing. With PV, we expect to study the potential of Argenx-113 and its autoantibody clearance mechanism to treat a range of skin blistering diseases beyond this beachhead indication, including, amongst others, bullous pemphigoid. And to wrap up 2018 milestones for Argenx-113, we plan to present top-line data from our phase 1 healthy volunteer study with a subcutaneous formulation, which has the potential to provide a significant advancement in convenience of treatment for patients with severe autoimmune conditions requiring long-term treatment. I'd like to turn now to our lead oncology candidate, Argenx-110, in the next slide 17. During the ASH annual meeting last December, we hosted a KOL workshop to announce updates from our phase 1/2 clinical trials in acute myeloid leukemia and cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Data from the phase 1/2 clinical trial for Argenx-110 in combination with azacitidine in 6 newly diagnosed elderly AML patients unfit for intensive chemotherapy showed encouraging signs of clinical activity, including complete remission in 3 out of 6 patients, complete remission with incomplete blood count recovery in 1 out of 6 patients, and partial response from 2 out of 6 patients. One of the patients who achieved a complete remission bridged to allogeneic stem cell transplant after 5 cycles. The preliminary data from the first set of patients, as shown on slide 18, suggest Argenx-110 is active both at the circulating and bone marrow blast level and at the leukemic stem cell level. The tolerability profile was also encouraging, with no exacerbation of azacitidine toxicity. As Dr. Gail Robos from Weill Cornell highlighted during the workshop, leukemic stem cells play a clear clinical role in AML, and those patients with remaining leukemic stem cells after initial treatment have higher rates of relapse. The leukemic stem cells lead to the accumulation of blasts in the bone marrow and therefore a reduction of other normal blood cells. The target of Argenx-110 CD70 has a unique and appealing expression profile in newly diagnosed AML patients. Slide 19. Firstly, it is expressed across all risk and age categories, regardless of mutational status. This differentiates it from drugs targeting certain mutations, which restrict their use to specific patient subsets only. Secondly, it is overexpressed on malignant cells only, while being absent on normal progenitor cells. Argenx-110 is designed to inhibit the CD70-CD27 pathway, thereby blocking symmetric division of leukemic stem cells, actually driving them back into normal myeloid differentiation. In this way, we believe Argenx-110 offers a unique and novel mechanism of action to the treatment landscape, which may be highly complementary to our current AML therapies. As a result of this enhanced effector functionality, it has also shown to take out mature blasts in the periphery. We also announced data during our ASH workshop from the phase 1/2 clinical trial of Argenx-110 in relapsed refractory CTCL patients, presented on slide number 20. Of the 22 CTCL patients under analysis, there was one complete response, two partial responses, and 10 patients achieving stable disease. Argenx-110 continues to show a favorable tolerability profile in CTCL patients. Slide 21. While current cohort sizes are small, we are highly encouraged by seeing responses in AML across the dose cohorts, and furthermore by having not reached any dose-limiting toxicity in patients. This encouraged us to amend the phase 1/2 AML trial to add an extra dose of 20 mg per kilogram to the dose escalation to best determine the recommended dose for the phase 2 proof of concept portion of the trial. In the year ahead, we look forward to presenting interim results from the phase 1/2 trial in AML, as well as presenting full data from the phase 2 study in AML and the phase 2 study in CTCL around the ASH annual meeting. Let's move to slide 22. In addition to our wholly owned programs, we also continue to fuel our pipeline through our innovative access program. We aim to seed our next pipeline programs by combining our cutting-edge antibody discovery capability with world-class disease biology expertise on novel pathways and targets under innovative deal structures, fairly sharing the economic return with the other party. In this way, we can access novel targets early on, enabling a portfolio management approach. Argenx-112, Argenx-115, and Argenx-116 are successful examples of this approach, and we currently have a portfolio of 7 live IAP programs. With regard to our licensing deals, we can provide the following update. We agreed with Bertrop Bio to mutually terminate our license agreement to develop and commercialize Argenx-109, while sub-licensee Genor will continue to develop the drug candidate in China. Meanwhile, we continue to make progress under our collaborations with AbbVie, with Shire, Leo Pharma, and Staten. I'd now like to turn the call over to our CFO, Eric Castaldi, for him to walk through the financials.
Thank you, Tim. So let's move to slide number 23. As you can see from this slide, our financial results primarily reflect research and development expenses and operating income. Operating income reached 41.3 million euros for the year ended December 31st, 2017, compared to 17.2 million euros for the same period in 2016. This significant increase in operating income in 2017 resulted principally from upfront payments and milestone payments received from our collaboration partners. We have a business model which relies heavily on outsourcing our R&D activities through external collaborations. Therefore, most of our operating expenses are variable expenses. On December 31st, 2017, R&D expenses amounted to 51.7 million euros compared to 31.6 million for the year ended in 2016. The increase in R&D expenses was mainly related to the advancements of our clinical development for Argenx 113 and 110 and other preclinical and discovery stage product candidates. Our SG&A expenses remain relatively low and reflect our lean and efficient structure. SG&A expenses totaled 12.4 million for the 12-month period ended on December 31, 2017, compared to 7 million euros for the same period of 2016. The increase seen in 2017 was mainly due to higher personal expenses, office costs, and consulting fees incurred to support our growth and also prepare us to become and operate as a NASDAQ-listed company. As a result, the company generated a total comprehensive loss of 28.1 million euros in 2017, compared to 21.4 million in 2016. We closed out 2017 with a very strong cash position, including our cash, cash equivalents, and current financial assets of 359.8 million euros, compared to 96.7 million euros on December 31st, 2016. The significant increase in our cash position resulted from our US public offerings completed in May and December 2017. Moving to slide number 24, this slide shows that so far we have been highly efficient in managing our capital. Since inception, we have raised a total of 475 million euros of capital, including the proceeds from our NASDAQ IPO completed in May 2017 and our follow-on US offering completed in December 2017. We also maintain a lean and efficient corporate structure. At the end of 2017, we employed 95 employees and consultants, of which 75 were in R&D and 20 in SG&A. With 359.8 million in cash at the end of December 2017, we believe that we are well capitalized to execute on our strategic plan. Our burn rate is expected to increase significantly as we will continue to focus our investments on our most advanced clinical development pipeline. In parallel, we will also advance and expand our preclinical product pipeline, looking to access novel targets and technologies. To conclude on this financial slide, you can see the fully diluted shareholding structure of Argenx as of February 28, 2018. In 2017, we raised approximately $380 million through two public offerings, the NASDAQ IPO in June, in May 2017, sorry, and the December follow-on, as a result of which we reduced our VC overhang to about 9.2% of the outstanding shares compared to 73% at the time of the Euronext IPO 4 years ago. These financings also attracted more blue-chip, long-term U.S. institutional investors, resulting in a current free float of more than 80%. And now I will turn the call back to Tim.
Tim? Thank you, Eric. I'm very proud of the Argenx team and our many accomplishments in 2017. We delivered on our promise to advance our pipeline and create value for our shareholders. Looking ahead to 2018 on slide 25, our focus will be on executing on the important milestones ahead, including reporting full data from the phase 2 proof of concept trial for Argenx 113 in myasthenia gravis at the AAN conference in April, reporting top line data from the phase 2 proof of concept study for Argenx 113 in ITP as well as interim data of the phase 2 proof of concept study in pemphigus vulgaris in the second half of 2018. Reporting the full data of the phase 1 healthy volunteer study with the subcutaneous formulation of Argenx-MON-13 during the second quarter of this year. Initiating the phase 3 trial for Argenx-MON-13 in myasthenia gravis by the end of the year. For Argenx-MON-10, we plan to provide an update on the ongoing phase 1/2 trial and report the full data of the AML phase 1/2 trial and CTCL phase 2 clinical trial in the second half of the year, and also launching the phase 2 proof of concept study for Argenx-MON-10 in AML before the end of the year. This is a very exciting time for Argenx, and we look forward to continuing to update you throughout 2018. With that, we'd like to open the call now for questions and answers. Operator?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Thank you. Our first question is from David Nierengarten at Wedbush SEC. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. I have a couple. So first off, you know, maybe you could help us on what the remaining things that you're looking to do before you start the phase 3 in myasthenia gravis. In other words, do you need to meet the FDA? When might that be, and when might you give us more details on the phase 3 trial design? And then the second question is on the ITT study, if you could help us with the reasons for the follow-up time extension and for the retreatment capability for the second amendment. I mean, frankly, is that because you're seeing responses? I suppose you can't tell us that, but is there any other rationale to have a retreatment capability for the second amendment? Thanks.
Good morning, David. Thanks for being with us today, and thank you for these questions. So what remains to be done before we can initiate the phase 3 myasthenia gravis trial is, as you correctly point out, an end of phase 2 meeting with the FDA. What we have said is that we will aim for an end of phase 2 meeting and a communication on the outcome of that end of phase 2 meeting before summer. We anticipate that the end of phase 2 meeting with the FDA will mainly focus on the minimum size of the safety database, the dose which we recommend to use in the phase 3, as well as the minimum exposure they want to see in these MG patients. So we are committed to communicate to our stakeholders on the outcome of that meeting as soon as we have the minutes. The reason for the follow-up extension and the retreatment arm in ITP is simply because we try to draw the lessons learned from the myasthenia gravis trial. As you may remember, all the patients which achieved a response on that study actually left the study in a durable response. So now we don't know how long actually these responses lasted. So trying to draw the lessons learned, and bear in mind these are different indications, and you cannot simply extrapolate the data, at least we wanted to amend the study such that if and when there would be a long-term response, we would be able to capture that response in its full duration. The idea to come up with the retreatment arm is also coming from the fact that now we have long-term tox data, which allow us actually to extend the exposure in patients and actually learn about what happens with patients which relapse. It will also allow us to rapidly expand the safety database because placebo patients will also be allowed to enroll in that treatment open label study. Okay.
Yep, okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question is from Boris Peaker from Cowen. Please go ahead.
Good morning. My first question is on the 113. I'm just curious, now, assuming that the sub-Q formulation works just as well as the IV formulation in healthy volunteers, which formulation do you plan to run in the phase 3 program? And also kind of an extension of this question from a competitive perspective, how important do you think it is to have a sub-Q formulation in the market versus the IV formulation?
Good morning, Boris. Thanks for your questions. So, given that our strategy is speed to market, it is important to keep our first registration trial, I think, as simple as possible. Today, we don't see any reason why we would not be able to launch a first phase 3 registration trial in MG with a plain vanilla IV product. We do believe that the sub-Q product is going to be important in order to expand the commercial footprint in the market as good as we can. So I think with offering both products, we will be able to just capture and follow patients in a more complete fashion as with just one IV product. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess just to want to understand that if the sub-Q is important, what is the timing and the strategy for getting then a label expansion and a sub-Q? I mean, would this be another study running in parallel to the phase 3 of the IV formulation? Or how do you plan to bring the sub-Q to market?
Yeah, I would like to refrain from answering that question. I think it's premature to answer it. Technically speaking, we're ready to launch that sub-Q product, of course, assuming positive data around middle of the year. Technically speaking, that product is going to be ready. The exact strategy on how we're going to play that has not been disclosed yet.
Gotcha. And just my last question on maybe, sorry, on 110, I believe you had one patient going to transplant. I'm just curious, do we know the outcome for this patient post-transplant?
Well, post-transplant, the patient is going off study. So what we know is that the transplant has been successful. We don't know what the fate of that patient actually is. Remember, this is a very unusual thing to happen for these elderly, unfit patients to be transplanted. So the only thing which we know according to protocol was that the transplant was successful, but then these people actually leave the study. So I don't have the update on how that patient is actually doing today.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for taking my questions.
Thank you, Boris.
Thank you. Our next question is from Sandra Cohenbergs at KBC Securities. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. I have a small follow-up question on the previous one with regard to the IV and the sub-Q. I fully understand that it's difficult to anticipate on how you're going to take it to market, but do you think that it could actually coexist like the IV in an acute stage, and then you actually give a sub-Q formulation as a follow-on treatment, for instance, for the condition of ITP? That was my first question. My second question is on the AML population, and that's for my own information. These are all newly diagnosed patients, so they did not receive any treatment prior to the start with Argenx 110. And then the third question is on whether it's possible to give us a little bit of guidance on the cash burn rate for 2018 in terms of R&D costs, SG&A, the amount of staff. Thanks.
Thank you, Sandra. I will hand over the third question to Eric in a minute. So I think the sub-Q product could be important or could not be important in ITP depending on the phase 2 data. So we don't know anything about how Argenx 113 performs in ITP, but we do want to be ready with a sub-Q product if and when we think that would be an attractive proposition in MG, ITP, or pemphigus. And there are a couple of analogies I would like to draw your attention to. For example, if you look at the HAE markets, people have initially been launching products to take care of acute flares, and then they have been launching sub-Q products to go into the maintenance setting. For chronic skin inflammation, there is a precedent, for example, in the IL-17 space, where people actually take patients through an IV induction phase, followed by sub-Q maintenance dosing at home. So I just believe that depending on what we're going to see in these phase 2 proof of concept trials, having that sub-Q card ready to play is giving us a lot of flexibility with regards to dosing and dosing regimens in order to serve these patients best. With regards to AML, it's correct that these are newly diagnosed patients. They have not been received, have not been receiving any medication. Typically, these people would be dosed, given they're unfit to receive the 7+3 chemotherapy, they would be given a hypomethylating agent as kind of palliative care. That would be Vidaza or decitabine. And that's also the reason why we have to go on top of Vidaza in this phase 1 study. You cannot deprive the patient from that standard of care, so we're dosing 110 on top of Vidaza. Bear in mind that we have been able to dose Argenx 110 as monotherapy for the first 2 weeks, then followed by introducing Vidaza on top of 110 in these patients. And I believe when you look at the ASH workshop data, that has proven a valuable strategy because we did collect useful information on what happens on 110 monotherapy as well as on Vidaza combo therapy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Eric, I would like to pass the burn rate question to you.
So on the third question, so we had a cash burn rate of approximately 50 million in 2017, and we anticipate that this cash burn will increase to roughly 80 million for 2018, which is in line with our business plan. With the current business plan, I would say, based on the current design of the trials, I mean, depending on the different interaction, notably with the FDA, we may have an increase or a decrease in this cash burn. So for the moment, it's 80 million. That's what it is. And as I mean, we have 350 million euros of cash at the end of 2017, and we expect that this is going to provide us with runway through all our current clinical trials and through one registrational trial for Argenx 130.
The 80 million, that's predominantly R&D costs, I suppose. Can you give some guidance on the administrative cost?
The administrative cost? So we had for this year 12.5 million euros, but that includes also costs like share-based payments, and this cost has increased significantly due to the increase of the share price. So I would say that we don't expect SG&A to increase significantly in 2018. We are working on, putting together a team to prepare the future commercial launch of 113 in the U.S. But nevertheless, I mean, we're talking about a few additions. So it also depends on the share-based payment, but we think that the SG&A cost will not increase substantially in 2018.
Okay, perfect. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Our next question is from Ted Tenthoff at Piper Jaffray. Please go ahead.
Great, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much for taking my question and on the update. My question is on ITP, and I appreciate the value of extending dosing for responders. Is there potential for some form of open label study for responders, not just to keep them on drug, but generate longer term safety data? And then the second question would be with respect to a regulatory endpoint, and it's a little bit early to be asking, but what is typically the duration required for our ITP? Thanks.
So Ted, on your first question, actually the retreatment arm is an open label study, which actually is going to run for 1 year. So we have ample of opportunity to treat placebo patients and retreat actually all patients from the primary study. And that is therefore a study arm which will continue to run whilst possibly we could already start to prepare for phase 3. So it's a great addition of retreatment information and safety information, which I think could pay off for the phase 3 design. Now, on the second question, I'm not sure I completely got that question. So would you mind just briefly repeating the point, please?
Yeah, and that's helpful on the update on the OLE. So on the second question was, with respect to an ultimate registrational trial, what kind of follow-up do you think might be required for on the primary endpoint and or safety?
Okay, so if you study historical registration trials, which is, I think, today the only thing which we can realistically do, if you study the registrational trials executed for the TPO receptor agonists being Nplate and L-trombopag, but also if you study the Rigel study on the SYK inhibitors, these are relatively small trials. I mean, they have been doing an order of magnitude two registration trials of about 75 patients each. These typically have been studies lasting about half a year, you know, 26 weeks. And then basically patients were rolled over in an open label retreatment arm to continue to collect data, which then feed into your BLA submission. So it's a pretty standard approach. I think these are manageable trials, manageable numbers of patients, manageable duration. It's a typical registrational design, which I think this company can execute credibly.
Great. Thanks, Tim. Very helpful. Keep up the good work.
You're welcome, Ted. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Stephanie Putt from DeGrussa. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to inquire about your strategy going towards other indications for 113. What would be your preferred route? Would that be to also tackle the larger indications by yourself in the future, or is there a possibility to partner larger indications while retaining the rights for orphan indications? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Stephanie. It's good to have you in the call. So you know that currently we're focused on executing the current phase 2 studies, right? So we have carefully selected these three beachheads, and actually we believe that there is potential in these individual spaces as soon as you see a convincing sign of efficacy. So we are thinking about the next indication. We are not going to disclose that thinking because the space is simply becoming more competitive than it used to be. Secondly, this compound actually is not available for partnering. We're not thinking about partnering certain rights to any third party. I think we will stay focused on executing for the moment our own business plan.
Okay, clear. Thank you.